Now, Walter, yes.
If you want to become part of our Stalinist club, I hope you did your duty and distribute questions so that there actually will be an appearance of free debates, but you know.
Stalin did actually give me a question, planted a question, but it was only to be used if no one else had questions. I'm up here just to say there are microphones on either side of the room. And what we thought we'd do is just have people line up at the microphones and then go back and forth from one to the other. So I'm going to wait for a second to give people a chance to get to the microphones. And if no one is at the microphone, then I will have to ask the extremely obscene question that I was planted with, and I won't do it. So just give it a second.
I don't know what game are you playing now.
I'm not playing. Here.
Do you really want to ask?
No, I don't. I'm not. Here,
and then you are bluffing and you don't even have the question. Sorry, please. Yes.
It was about a dog.
Just, I hope it works with
so
sound.
You just go there and there and I'll let you.
No, the mic, I hope it works, no?
No, it doesn't. Okay,
it does, perfect, okay. Thank you, it does.
One of the premises of critical thinking, of course, it's reflexivity, and it's the awareness of the conditions of possibility of... And when you talk about this incredibly charming, and of course I'm enthusiastic about it in a more in a political sense than in an epistemological one, this idea of putting the lenses and kind of seeing the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a fiction of transparency that we as intellectuals are able to unveil the reality. But of course, we have to be aware of our own standpoint when we do that. So I don't know, I'm very curious about that idea of this sort of standpoint. We don't have the answers, which I think it's something that I appreciated listening to you saying that in the last part. But this idea that there's a move of unveiling and there's an assumption that there's some hidden truth out there that we're going to be able to find. And how do you reconcile that as a standpoint of being an intellectual with the reflexivity of actually being aware of their own conditions and their relative conditions?
Wonderful question. Again, the only problem is that it's, as you admitted, it's a one-hour answer question. Okay, very
you can
briefly.
Give me a short answer.
Very briefly. My answer would have been that the truth to which we do have access is not a positive truth in the sense of I magically step out of myself and see the things the way they really are. What we can see is the inherent untruth of what is going on. What do I mean by this? A wonderful example that I really liked. For example, Jacques Lacan says somewhere something which has a male chauvinist twist. I don't like that. But if you take the form of it, it's wonderfully true. He says, let's take a husband who is pathologically jealous about his wife sleeping with other men. And he says, even if all his suspicions are true, the wife is really doing it, his jealousy is still pathological. And in this sense, you know, I'm not saying compare it with truth. I would like to apply this to racism. For example, I already did it in one of my books, to anti-Semitism. Let's say we are in the 30s, late 30s in Germany. I am a Nazi, you are not a Nazi. We debate the role of the Jews. The moment we formulate it as, let's compare racist prejudices with the Jews the way they really are, if you are the anti-Nazi, you sell your soul to the devil. Because the true problem is not that of abstract truth in the sense of are Jews really like that. Once you debate about this, you come to some kind of a stupid mixed result. Jews exploited the Germans. Well, in some vulgar sense, this was up to a point true, because purely formal sense, because some Jews definitely were rich. And you know, or, I don't know, Jews were seducing and corrupting German girls. Well, I hope they did, as everyone. You know what I mean? That's not the problem. The problem is not, is it true? The problem is, why did the Nazis, in order to sustain the consistency of their ideological project, why did they need the figure of the Jew? And at this level, you can tell the truth. It's an immanent truth. It's a truth of what pushes you to say what you say. It's not the objective truth. In this sense, I believe this is the truth that critique of ideology can bring out. It's not objective theory of society independently of a standpoint, and said that I cannot develop it, but quite on the contrary. What already Hegel knew, and what we should keep from Marx, is that universality and partisanship, in the sense of taking sides, are not mutually exclusive. To go even further, and that's a great ethical idea, I claim, that truth is partial and doesn't lose, because of this, paradoxically, its universality. In other words, when you have a complex situation of struggle, the right position is not, oh, you are claiming this, you are claiming that, I will step back and look for it from it objectively and see truth is somewhere in the middle. No, in a radical struggle, one part, even if it's formally a minority, stands for the truth. For example, again, back to Germany, you cannot say, Jews were right, but they exaggerated a little bit. Hitler was a little bit right, so somewhere in the middle. No, Hitler was a lie, even if maybe, I'm not saying definitely not most of it, even if you prove me that some minor things that he claimed, he said about Jews are literally true, it's still a total lie. So again, I'm not, when I criticize ideology, I'm not talking about some kind of objective truth independent of engagement. Truth is for me a category of an engaged partial category. Partial, but nonetheless universal. Okay, I cannot go, I would love to, but... you are now opportunist, oscillating between left and right. No, it's noticed, please.
This is a question in honor of the sadly recently deceased media theorist Friedrich Kittler.
Yeah.
You were mentioning the sixth sense technology.
Yeah.
And to me, you seem to describe it as though this technology is somehow mapped with certain ideological, like almost mapped by its ideological environment. I was wondering if you could think of an example where perhaps it's in fact the media that generates ideology, that maybe the causality might be reversed.
Now you caught me here. I don't like to bluff. You caught me here. I don't want to bluff too much, but from what I know, I think it is clear that it's not so much that there is ideology, but that, for example, if you take cinema, isn't it clear there were detailed historical analyses demonstrating how the whole idea of camera, cinema registration, the way we have it, presupposes the typically modern notion of perspective reality and so on, which is by no means natural. Or, to go even further, isn't it clear that what happened with this privatization of listening to music, where listening to music is no longer a public experience, but more and more you alone, isn't this also a clear case of technology causing, although, you know, I'm here try to be more open in the sense that I'm not sure I would totally agree here with Kittler, although, I mean, he wasn't alone. He had some pupils who were doing excellent job, and you must know the irony how they were referred to. Hitler Jugend, you know, cannot resist saying it. But what I want to say is that, nonetheless, I claim that the relationship is one of mutual influence. I don't believe that you can isolate some purely technological mechanism which is the zero level, and then maybe it's retroactively influenced by ideology. But no, if anything, I claim that ideology has a priority, that there is no zero-level technology which does not already materialize a certain set of ideological presuppositions. But of course, here, ideology is not the traditional ideology. I mean, in the sense of a worldview, blah, blah, blah. What interests me much more is this, let's call it in Michel Foucault, Foucauldian way, micro-ideology, you know, as I did in that stupid passage, which everyone is quoting, but I'm horrified by it, from the beginning of Plague of Fantasies, the structure of toilets, American, European, German. You know, no, I find this, I will not tell you this story, you all know it, but what interests me is this ideology, you know, an apparently just disgusting private ritual, sitting, going to toilet. You see, we are there already in ideology. But so again, this would have been maybe my prejudice, that I don't, not against Hitler, but because it's more unclear how he means, but against this simplistic reading of technological inventions generating ideology. I think that technological inventions are rather open, and even if an ideology was at work in how they were conceived, they can escape this control of ideology and so on. So again, I would just render the things more complex here. Sorry, I don't have a more intelligent answer here. Okay.
Thanks. I guess my question is, you talked about the financial crisis and also simultaneously a crisis of imagination.
Yeah.
So first part of the question is, what would it take for that to change? And sort of alternatively, why don't you start a Leninist party?
Sorry, why don't I?
Why don't you start a Leninist party? Like, if it's absurd.
This is, I think that unfortunately, although it's much more complex, now I will do a little bit of self-propaganda. The big answer will be the book that I've just finished on Hegel, where I try to do the return from Marx to Hegel. And this book, it's a modest short book. It will have just 1,200 printed pages, so it's madness. But there, I try to point in what sense Marx and especially Lenin are, in a way, more idealists than Hegel. Marx and Lenin imply something which for Hegel is totally prohibited and unthinkable. The idea that a determinate historical agent, like working class of party, can get to know the general tendency of history. It can be put in a more crude way, we are realizing historical necessity, or in a more subtle way, like in the young Lukács and so on. But nonetheless, can kind of get to know the general tendency of history and then act as an agent based on this knowledge. This is, for me, what is too much already in Marx, especially in Lenin. Now, I'm not saying that we should simply go back to some kind of abstract decisionism, you don't know what you are doing, and so on and so on. But certainly, I find problematic this idea of legitimizing your activity by direct historical knowledge so that you can say, I know where things are moving, I'm the agent of this change. If Hegel's idea of List der Vernunft, cunning of reason, has any meaning, it is precisely that whenever you do these things always get wrong. This is why, incidentally, I'm also absolutely for Hegel's idea of cunning of reason. It's not a primitive teleological idea, we do what we do, but some mysterious reason steers us, controls us. It's on the contrary. The cunning of reason means basically when you plan something, one thing is sure, it will for sure go wrong, like that there will be another result out of it. So again, this is my basic problem. Although Lenin, again, is here more ambiguous, even Lenin, but nonetheless, the basic idea of the avant-garde party is this one. And I think that, again, without celebrating the spontaneism of the working class, I'm not saying against Lenin that we should trust the ordinary people. No, nobody knows, neither the party nor the people. But from there, but their gap should be maintained. Like, I always deeply distrust those who celebrate the wisdom of the ordinary people. These are usually the true elitists, because, you know, the trick is that when you celebrate the wisdom of the ordinary people, it always usually means that you are the one who speaks for them, who knows better than themselves. There is a wonderful line in Orson Welles, you all know it, Citizen Kane. You remember, in the middle of the film, Kane is accused by a conservative banker who comes to visit him. Like, it's horrible. You try to please the crowd. You evoke the lowest instincts of the poor. You speak for them, for the rebel. And you must remember Kane's, Orson Welles' answer. It is, yes, I speak for the poor, ordinary people, but are you aware that if I don't speak for them, they may start to speak for themselves, no? And that will be the truly dangerous moment, no? Sorry. So again, don't you think that one of the problems of 20th century was precisely that this idea went triumphantly wrong? I still think the beginning of the October Revolution was an incredible emancipatory moment. I absolutely insist on it. But on the other hand, unfortunately, I cannot buy the simplistic narrative of some of my Trotskyite friends that you know. Oh, if only Lenin were to survive 3 years more, made a pact with Trotsky, then we would have a wonderful, thriving socialist democracy. It was an authentic tragedy. I mean, maybe it wasn't inevitable, but we can see logically how it became Stalinism, but nonetheless, we should not, this doesn't take anything away from the greatness of the origins. You know what I mean? It's an authentic tragedy, in contrast to Nazism, where is no tragedy like that. Nazis were, to put it in naive terms, very bad people who said, if we take power, we will do some bad things. And what a miracle, when they did take power, they did these bad things, no? You don't have this, which is why in fascism, especially Nazism, you don't have dissidents. Nobody reproached Hitler of, maybe Heidegger at some crazy problem, of betraying the inner essence of Nazism or whatever, no? Again, this is, but I agree with you, this is a very complex topic, and maybe I exaggerated a little bit too much. I'm not an irrational decisionist. I'm not saying we know nothing, we should just act or whatever. No, we need knowledge more than ever. You know who is my hero here? Maybe you know the story, I excuse myself, of this false identity with ordinary people. Terry Eagleton told me what happened 30 years ago when the great Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm gave a talk to ordinary workers in a factory and to kiss their ass, how to put it, to become, started in this way of, listen, I don't know anything basically more than you. It's not only that I'm teaching you here, I'm here to learn from you. You know, playing this solidarity with the people. And then a miracle happened. One ordinary worker stood up and said, literally, fuck off, you are bullshitting. You know, you are educated, paid to know, you should teach us what you know. Don't give us this bullshit. You know, this is the only honest attitude. This means not patronizing ordinary people. No? So again, I'm not saying we know nothing. We know many things we should. Just, this knowledge does not have this strong, predictive, let's call it performative form. There is a gap there. Sorry, again, I didn't answer, but that's life, no?
So let's do leave one more here and then we'll...
So, okay, well, question here. So you remember...
Are you Russian like me, Slavic?
No, I didn't say Slavic. I said you remember that...
Sorry. No, because of the accent, yeah.
That who Lenin called youthful idiots.
Yeah.
So Putin organized a channel in the United States called Russia Today.
Yeah.
Where all kind of youthful idiots describe how United States doing very poorly. In the same time, he already 12 hours in power put some kind of puppet president and supposed to be president of Russia for life, like a Tsar something.
Yeah.
How would you comment this kind of event of transfer from socialism, communism so-called, to capitalism?
Maybe my answer will surprise you. First, let me make it absolutely clear. I have no sympathy whatsoever for Putin. I visited once Russia 2-3 years ago, and I didn't know who invited me. It was that guy called Gleb something. Who,
Pavlovsky, Gleb Pavlovsky.
Yeah, who afterwards I learned, my God, this guy is Putin's PR man.
But he was fired now.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a hope then. Oh, perfect. Okay, no. And this is why then I didn't want to visit Russia, because I was afraid again of getting caught into some kind of game like that. But you know what makes me really sad? It's relatively easy to explain how it came out the way it came out. I don't think the truly sad thing is that maybe not Putin. The sad thing about Putin regime for me, and although it was the situation was different, it started already under Yeltsin, is that the tragedy of Russia, I think, is that the way they passed to capitalism is to open up the field for the most non-productive capitalism. You privatize banks, natural resources, like the Chinese did it in a much more intelligent way. They started with small companies producing for consumerist market, private, you know, where you were able to slowly see how it works, and nonetheless, ordinary people felt some right in Russia. This is for me the tragedy. The whole structure remained inefficient. All that, if I simplify it, happened was that some guys monopolized natural resources, banks were privatized. It's horrible. And here I'm almost paranoia claiming maybe all the advice given to Russians by American economists were not so innocent. Maybe they said, maybe we should help Russia a little bit to remain weak, you know. But you know what really made me sad when some of my friends were in Russia? How, even if there is still very little, I know, but some kind of freedom, you can criticize a little bit Putin, but aren't people more or less resigned already, no? People, more and more, I was told, especially intellectuals, they accepted it. It's horrible, but it's fate. Probably nothing will change. It will go on like that. And I'm just very sad for Russia at this level. I don't know what could happen, no? It's a certain... Do you, maybe you have, this is what I meant interrupting you, sorry. That
sure. They resigned in sense that they don't believe that it's legal way to change this regime.
Yeah.
Any illegal way, what happened, it could not be predicted. Everybody predicts this in 2 years, in 20 years, but it's all not hard to analyze.
But didn't this already start this Finnish season? For example, I don't have, again, any illusions about Khrushchev. But one thing was interesting. Wasn't Khrushchev the last moment of the communist regime when, even if it all was a cynical fake, there was some kind of belief, you know, we will maybe overtake you, you know, believe in, we are doing something that may succeed.
That overcome America in 1980.
Well, isn't it that with Brezhnev the game was over? Not even nomenklatura, nobody believed in it. So this confirms my tragic experience in my country with how more and more, this is my personal experience in ex-Yugoslavia in the last 20 years. It wasn't only that the ideology was cynical in the sense of people didn't take it seriously. You were prohibited to take it seriously. I had two friends who worked in Central Committee or some cultural commission, whatever, and they really believed in Yugoslav self-management socialism. They lost their job. Because the nomenklatura thought that, like, you know, sincerely believing in official ideology meant the first step towards dissidence. So, and I'm sorry, again, we don't have time. I have wonderful, Slovenia was a small country where everybody knew everybody well. So when, as a young student, I was once there when General Secretary of the party gave a speech where he says, you young communists should not only do theory, you should also follow the fourth thesis of Feuerbach. philosophers have only interpreted the world, we have to change it. Then afterwards, I approached him and said, please, Comrade Secretary, if you will repeat this speech, be careful. It's the 11th thesis, you know. You know what his answer? I know it, but that was my message. I don't care. You know, him there, he, in a nice way, and this is what really fascinates me. This is more and more, I'm sorry if I will conclude with an old joke of mine, how ideology functions today. It's not only, it doesn't matter if you believe it, you actively should not. Like, I'm sorry if I repeat this for the 10th time, but it's perfect. You know that Niels Bohr story, you know, he was visited by a friend in the countryside. The friend saw a horseshoe, superstitious item in Europe. No, if you put horseshoe above the entrance to a house, evil spirits will not enter it. And he asks Niels Bohr, my God, are you crazy? Aren't you a scientist? Do you really believe in this superstition? And Bohr gave him a perfect answer. He says, of course I don't believe in it. I'm a scientist. But I have it there because I was told that it works even if you don't believe in it. No? This is ideology today. We don't have to believe it. We just practice ideology. No? So thank you. But again, this would be a wonderful debate. No? Because I think... But let's agree in one thing. Don't you agree that the political jokes from communist countries were a great spiritual legacy which unfortunately disappeared now?
Of course, but they will appear with jokes about Putin now.
Yeah, but aren't they just a pale repetition of the true greatness of jokes on Stalin, unfortunately?